I'm Jenny Nevinson, and you are listening to the Minder Podcast.
Welcome to episode 32 of the Minder Podcast in association with Minder.org. I am your host, Paul Stenning. In this episode, we feature an exclusive interview with Stuart St. Paul, who appeared in the classic Whose Wife Is It Anyway? From series 2 of Minder. It was a small part, but I could not resist speaking with Stuart, as not only did he appear in one of, if not the best of episodes, but he was also later the stuntman for Dennis Waterman in Stay Lucky. In fact, Stuart started out as a stuntman, which was helped greatly by his background in martial arts. He was also assistant to both Tony Blackburn and Noel Edmonds on radio, and eventually took over the Steve Wright Show as Steve moved to Radio 1. Later, Stuart would play the Queen Alien for James Cameron. He also did 3 Bond films and was in the original Batman, Superman, and Robin Hood. He became a screenwriter and was a producer on The Craze as well as his own projects. He stayed on as an action advisor on many hit shows. The continuing ITV drama Emmerdale used him to help design the plane crash in 1993 and then retained him for another 26 years. Whilst at Emmerdale, he worked with Alan Lewis and knew he had been in something with him before. How could Alan forget his old mate from the gay bar? So Stuart and I talk about the location and setup of the gay club in Whose Wife Is It Anyway, as well as some great insights into working on the show. Stuart has some great stories, not least of which is the tale about meeting with casting director Weston Drury Jr., who saw something very unexpected during their meeting. It stands as probably one of my favourite stories from doing this show. This is a fun conversation about a classic episode and a wealth of other interesting material. So if you are feeling super, then let's get on with the show. Yeah, so did you manage to watch the episode?
I did. We watched it last night, actually.
What did you make of it?
Watching an old Minder episode from the early 80s is a bit of a shock when you've not seen one for a while. And it kind of, it brought back a lot of memories, really, because the first thing that hit me was Dennis looks so young. And I probably knew him better when he was older. At that point, I was just meeting him as a young actor. I wasn't really a friend of his. So that was a shock, seeing Dennis look so young. The second shock was seeing I look so young, which is really weird. And it was going back to, I was thinking about it last night, it's a point really in my career, which was a low point. You know, I've had a great career, but that was probably the low point of my career, the point where I was going in the wrong direction and I need to make a change. So that was, it was quite weird to sort of think back to that. It must have been, I'm guessing, 81, 82.
It was 80. It was filmed in March of 1980 and screened later that year, yeah.
Wow. So yeah, that was a sort of a weird period for me. So yeah, it was just a reminder of that. The show itself, I mean, I couldn't help but laugh. It's a funny episode.
Yeah.
But it's one you couldn't make nowadays because the references would be considered to be unwoke, to put it bluntly. And the funny thing is, I'm off to somebody's special birthday at the weekend, and he is holding it at the Phoenix Club. And afterwards, there is the drag act is going to be on. So it's going to be a very gay evening. So it was really weird seeing me and Dennis there in a gay club. And on Saturday, quite out of the blue, I'm off to a gay club with a friend for his special birthday. So yeah, that was really odd. And some of the language, I mean, was odd. It almost made me squirm a bit in a way, which is strange. But that's just shows you how eras can be so different, doesn't it?
I mean,
But
one of the reasons it's still so good is because of that in its own way, because it represents A, the time, but also it's timeless, but it's like you say, you couldn't make it now, and we know therefore we can never get this again. I think that's part of it.
well, I mean, that may all come back. Who knows? History is a sine wave. It swings backwards and forwards. And people choose to believe in whichever history story they're told. So that to me is actually a piece of history. It does actually tell us what the 80s was like and the late 70s. I think it's very accurate in that. I've been watching a program about Egyptology on the television recently. And it's amazing how much of that is absolutely truly documented. But you go to other eras in history and it isn't documented, whereas that is a true documentation of the late 70s, early 80s. And it will be studied. It'll be studied as a piece of history. So it will last forever.
So you told me a very funny story about how you were cast for that.
Yeah, in fact, when I watched it, I realized there were two funny stories, and I told my wife one that she didn't know. So, the first story really is that at this time, I had fallen into acting. So, 1980, I had fallen into acting. I just spent 10 years as a radio DJ on the radio with my own show. And I'd literally left a northern station and been transferred down to Ipswich to take over the Steve Wright show when Steve got his job at Radio One. So I was pretty hot and I was hoping to go back to Radio One, which is where I started and where I was trained. Then I was offered a job on television as a DJ in a series called Radio Phoenix about a radio station. I was only ever meant to do four episodes, but when I went in, they signed me after about two episodes, they signed me for the whole year. So that changed. And all of a sudden, by default, I'd become an actor. Now, when that show got pulled, as it did, I found myself an actor. And that's what I call the low point in my career because I didn't enjoy it and I didn't like it. And what I didn't like about it was you had to go through all of these hoops to get jobs. You had to go and see a casting director. He had to wait to go and see a casting director. Then out of all the 30 actors he saw, he would then cast you in a role. And what a lot of people don't realize, and I can tell you now because I've spent 50 years in this industry, is that the director gets to choose from a small group of people, if he gets to choose at all, and at a lot of shows, especially television, the director doesn't choose his cast. Like a football manager doesn't always choose the footballers he's managing. So I was then looking for jobs. So the story that I told you was that I went off to Western Drury. Actually, I need to tell you another story first. I was frustrated as an actor. So two great casting director friends of mine at the time, and these are like classic icons, Marilyn Johnson and Esther Charkham, big casting directors, had both said to me, "Look, you've lived a pretty loud career at the top of the industry, and you're an athlete, which is really unusual." Somebody who's I was used to I fought in three national judo championships. I had quite a high belt in taekwondo. I swam for Essex. I ran for Essex. I was an athlete. They said, "You could go into stunts." Now, it might sound daft, but you will pick up all the small roles. You won't have to audition. They'll get given to you because you are physically capable of doing the role in a movie, and they'll carry you in the team. You'll play more roles as a stuntman than you ever will as an actor. And you'll be working on top class A-list entertainment material all the time, constantly, 12 months of the year, because there are so few of you. And, you know, I, at the time, I was a good looking young fella. So that was it. So I started to do my transition, as it were, to use a gay term, into the stunt section of Equity, which wasn't difficult, but there were hoops and exams I had to do. So I met Weston Drury, who is the casting director of Minder, during that time when I was transitioning to become a stuntman. So I go in to see Weston. He's called me in. Lovely man. And I'm going, listen, I'd love to be on Minder. I love the show. It's everything I love about television. It's action-based. It's funny. It moves along. It's not character-led. It's pace-driven. And Minder's fun. So that's, I'd love to be in the show. And I confide. I've been in 3G. I'm telling him all my history of, you know, national championships in judo, fighting in Newcastle, fighting in Glasgow. And he just sits there stone-faced like a judge watching me do my performance in my 10-minute slot as an actor auditioning for him. Just me. It wasn't a queue of guys. So I go home and I say to my wife, I think I did really well. You know, I just tell him, and she doesn't. She was, yeah. The phone rings the next day, and my agent says, Minder's offered you a part. You don't even have to go in. You've just been offered this part. I'm thinking, great. Script's going to be in the post. Yeah, take it. I'll do it. I wasn't even thinking what it would be. Script comes in. I'm going through, looking for my part, and I'm in a gay club playing a guy called Gary, who goes up and says hello to Dennis. Has to be fairly camp because that's what it says in the script. So I've been trying to convince Weston Drury that I'm this tough guy. And he's gone, no, you know what you look like? You look like the kind of guy who should be in this club next week when we film Minder. And I'm thinking, you just got to give up. I mean, it's... So that was the period I didn't like. I loved being in Minder. It was the first time I met Dennis. I did not know it was going to change my career. I didn't know that Dennis and I would become great friends and that I would then go on to be his stunt double through the whole of Stay Lucky and that series which you mentioned, the SAS series that you did.
Circle of Deceit. I don't know what
it's called. That's it, Circles of Deceit. And a few other things I think I went with him. So, yeah, we had many years together. Fun years because he was a really ordinary, nice guy. He had time for everybody. We used to go for a drink afterwards. The writer of Stay Lucky was the same. Lovely guy. He's passed away as well. He passed away a long time ago. Dennis only went recently. So I guess I'm next. Frightening. That was a long relationship with Dennis that didn't really come out of that period. But that episode was key in me thinking, you know, I've got to get out of that team because I don't want to have to wait and beg for a job. I don't want to have to go for castings. I want to be in the era where I'm getting the roles in the films and the TV shows I want to be in. Mm-hmm. And if I have to queue up to get one line in Minder, no, acting's not for me. I'm going to move into stunts. So that was a definite. The other funny story is the guy I'm in the club with, Brian Jameson, I think.
Yeah.
And the two of us were at the bar and we came over to meet Dennis. Brian and I were both shortlisted for a live soap. We were the last two to play this particular character in this new experiment for TVS. And it was about a year earlier. And I can't remember what the character was. That's irrelevant. Doesn't matter. But it was a live soap that was going out at 1 o'clock, a bit like The Archers. It was just a soap, TV, but live in the studio. Like literally, bang, you're on. You're allowed to walk through and do your parts. And they wanted to give me the role, but they didn't trust because I'd never acted. I was a DJ and I freewheeled a lot with my output, as DJs do. They just thought I wouldn't be able to remember the script, stay on script, or be on that line of thought. They weren't worried I couldn't perform live, but they were worried I couldn't keep the script in my head while we were going live. So they didn't risk it with me, and they cast Brian Jameson. And that's the weird thing. And the show failed. it was only on for a very short time. And then they did Radio Phoenix and they called me straight back in and said, you can play the DJ. So that was really weird because I'd met Ryan before at the audition for a show called Living Together. So yeah, that just watching that Minder brought back so many memories. So many memories. I mean, I've got so many memories of me and Dennis going out and getting rather drunk as well. So yeah, the years that followed. Stay Lucky was a great show.
I definitely want to get onto that and ask you about that. But just for the actual gay bar scene, I can't find anywhere where that actual scene was filmed. Was it a real bar or was it studio?
Well, up until recently, I had kept every call sheet of every job I'd done. But when we were trying to, like, be thinking, I need to clear the house out because one day the kids are going to have to do this after I've popped off. I've kept all the contracts, but I got rid of all the call sheets, which must have been a whole bookcase full of files because I've worked on thousands of productions now in 50 years. If I'd got the call sheet, it might have listed where that was. From memory, it was obviously in London. I seem to remember us going downstairs into some arches.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't mind betting they thought gay club went to somewhere like Heaven, which was very popular then, and worked in the arches under Charing Cross somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I used to go to Heaven, not a lot, but occasionally I'd go to Heaven. And there were, if I remember, there was a huge dance floor in Heaven, but there were some bars with arches. Now, somebody might know better than me, but it may have been in a section of there. If not, I bet it was a little club near there that was in a similar set of underground railway arches.
That makes sense because a few episodes before that, I'm sure they filmed in Heaven. I'm sure they did.
Wow.
It looked different than in your episode, but yeah, some obviously around there they were definitely filming.
But if you look at the way it was filmed, I don't think there's a wide shot of that nightclub.
It's very narrow.
It's very narrow. It's shot against a pillar. Almost, with the bar just in the background. So you get the brickwork, the pillar,
yes,
and the bar. And then as somebody walks away, I think Dennis gets called away, they kind of just play to the other side of the pillar.
Yeah.
Which is a very clever way of making something look big when it isn't.
Yeah.
And it also, in TV terms, the way television is filmed is fast, very fast. And a lot of actors get really shocked when they come onto a show like Minder or The Bill, very similar kind of show in filming terms, where the show runs like clockwork. The crew know how to make the show. They know how to make it quickly. They know how they've got to get how many scenes in a day. So they're literally in, put up the lights, shoot it, leave. And if you come in for an odd scene, the crew just, they go. They'll jump in their vans and they're off to the next location and you're left there going, and somebody just says, oh, there's a cab coming for you in a minute. So the idea to shoot quickly would be to light one area. So you get the lights and you'd flood the bar and the pillar and the side of it, literally three lamps on one plane, and play the plane in and out to make it look big, shoot the scene and off.
Mm-hmm.
You'd hit your couple of close-ups, right? A lot of time to go. That that's the way that scene would have been shot. I don't remember being there a long time, maybe 2 hours at most in the whole club. And that would be a long time, really, for that scene.
Yeah, well, after an hour, we'll use this place called a
James, Winter's my Inn. Dear. What's he saying to Gary? What on earth is James doing here without Alex keeping a watchful eye on him?
Hello, Ron, Gary, how are you?
Hello. Well, aren't you going to introduce us to your friend?
Terry, how's it going, mate?
Hello, Chaz.
Hey, come on, let's buy you a drink.
No, I'm just here to pick up a plant.
I thought you'd give the mini cab enough. No, I won't hang about. I can see you're busy with your friend. What's that supposed to mean?
Oh, nothing. Just that I heard how you changed your living arrangements, like.
No, listen,
Jazz.
Oh, leave off. It's just a joke. That's a job. Got it?
Got it, got it.
Yeah?
It's me, Terry.
Well, what's your game? What do you want?
And don't be alarmed. I'm not after your body. I just want to say something.
Yeah, what? All right, you don't have to sit there to say whatever it is, do you?
But don't be ridiculous. I just want to apologise for my attitude since you've been here. It was very childish of me. I mean, you're doing this for me as much as Alex. And I do appreciate it, really.
Oh. Yeah, well, all right then. Ta.
Good. So tomorrow we'll start afresh, yes?
Your gear, Terry. I saw your light was on, so I just come up. Sorry if I disturbed you.
Oi! Arthur! Arthur!
So for you, you were kind of brought in for that scene and then you could go home, presumably. Or
yeah,
did you...
literally, I would have turned up at the required time, probably first thing in the morning because they want to check you for makeup, wigs, haircut, anything that might be wrong. And then, yes, soon as you finish the scene, they don't want to carry you on. Mm. They don't actually want to buy you a lunch because in those days, although they've got a catering truck, whether it be a TV or a commercial, there's a catering truck that follows the crew. Now, the reason that's there is because they don't want anybody to leave. Nobody gets to leave, and nobody probably gets a full lunch hour. Certainly HODs don't. When I was directing, never had a lunch hour. When I was a stuntman, rarely. When I was a stunt coordinator, did you actually get a lunch hour? And your days were 18 hours long. So the truck's there because you literally have to be fed. But everybody, the way the truck charges is like there's a retainer fee, and then there'll be a meal fee. In those days, it would be about 10 or 12 quid. Nowadays, it'd be about 40 or 50 quid per head. Mm. So they count the plates at the end of the day, and that bill goes through to production. So if they can lose two of you before lunch, it saves them 40 quid.
Yeah.
So they would. As soon as you're finished, gone. Weird, eh?
Well, yeah, it is. It's fast-paced. What was Alan Lewis like offset, if you had time to speak with him?
Well, Alan was a really good group player. And I remember he was very helpful and everything. But he had, you find actors, we don't chat a lot on set because we're getting into our, or he's getting into his role. They're all remembering their lines. I only had to remember a couple of words. So it wasn't a big thing for me. I just watched the camera. I was watching Roy Ward, Baker, I think it was, who was directing that one. Yeah. Watching him work, learning all the time because I wanted to end up. I'd already made the decision. I wasn't going to stay being an actor. I wanted to direct. So I went stunt coordinator, director. Alan was great. Now, did he go on to go into Emmerdale afterwards?
Yeah.
Did.
Yeah.
So I did ML for 26 years. So I went in and designed a plane crash for ML. And then they kept me on to do every piece of action that ever went through, had to come over my desk. So I was retained by ML for 26 years. And I obviously met Alan for the plane crash when it blew up there in there. And we did one of those, I know you. And you know, I never worked out where it was from until I watched that show last night.
Wow.
So I'd gone through Emmerdale with Alan, and that's why I had to say to you, it's the same guy, isn't it? Thinking, I know you. I really know you. We've done something together. Neither of us could ever remember. And that was it. So he was a great guy. I loved him on Emmerdale because he was a bloke. And it's just nice to have people that are very similar to you that you can relate to. But I mean, it was a big shame when he left Emmerdale. But I can understand why he would. He was a great actor, and he wouldn't want to be pigeonholed in that. He's probably in it for longer than he ever wanted to be.
Yeah,
so, yeah, he was a great guy. Why are you asking about Alan? Is there some special reason about that?
I just think in that episode, he's probably the best guest actor that ever came onto Minder for that episode because
yeah, he is. I mean, he's such a good actor. And he probably was. It was like in his Richard Beckinsale period, wasn't he? he looked fantastic, and he was great. But it was funny watching him because Gene and I both said to each other, you know, you wouldn't act like that now. There were touches of things which you would now, he wouldn't. You'd pull it back. It would be more real. And that was just paced up a little bit more than you would. But then it was what we used to call, what was the term? Comedy drama. So you might not have heard this term before, but there used to be a term, and it was used mainly throughout the 80s, called comedy drama, which Mindler fell into. Mm-hmm. So the show umbrella for it was comedy drama, normally made by the comedy department, but it was actually a drama. Stay Lucky was a comedy drama, without a doubt. Yeah. So these shows normally always went out on a Tuesday night at 9 o'clock. Tuesday night was the comedy drama slot at 9 o'clock. And Alan, I mean, he's just perfectly pitched for that kind of show. I can imagine he would. I'm trying to think of another guest actor we had in that, but I don't. See, I wasn't really on Mindo. My stunt years hadn't started then. Otherwise, I probably would have made more of them. You know, I'd previously played a DJ on Mindo. On Mindo, there's an episode just before Whose Wife Is It Anyway? It may have been the episode before. It might have been a couple after. But it might have been the end of series one. But there's a nightclub scene again, and there's a DJ in the background. So Western Jury had given me that before meeting me. And then after I did that, he called me in for that scene.
So I think that could be the one that I was mentioning in the nightclub. I think that could be it. It was Monday Night Fever, the episode.
Yes. Yes, it could be.
I'll send it to
but
you.
I was never there.
Check.
I never went to the set. So that, I literally was called in while they were editing. And I went into a sound studio, a bit like this. This is if you can see in the back of it, these are duvets hanging up at the side. So they're held by curtain bands. So when they're released, the duvets come round and turn this into a sound booth.
Yeah.
So I went into a sound booth in Soho. Nowadays, all the actors have their sound booths at home. But in those days.
Do you mean on the. On the episode, you were just like a voiceover DJ.
Yeah, just went in and DJed the gap in the program.
I think I may know what that was then. If you weren't actually on set, it could have been the second episode, which is where you, if it's you, there is a DJ that reads out a competition and then it's the competition winner. Again, I'd send you that just to see if that's you. I mean, obviously, I probably could tell now of hearing your voice.
I don't think that was it. I've got a feeling it's just a background nightclub DJ. So that might be the episode you referred to first.
Right.
Bearing in mind the period of me meeting Western Jury, they'd be close together. It's unlikely it would be the beginning of another series.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's then after that.
It's interesting this because it just shows you with credits on IMDb now. If they're not, they're obviously not with yourself conclusive because your very first role on there as an actor is the episode we were talking about. So there's nothing before that in terms of acting work. And then your stunt work is also the same year, it says. I think it's not written down what it was, but it says stunt coordinator in 1980. So your first role of that was then as well, according to them.
It was a confusing period. The DJ role may have been straight afterwards. Western may have gone, okay, yeah, we met Stuart for that role and we can just get him to do the DJ in this one. May have been after. What happened? The reason I didn't go stay in Mindo or go back to Mindo was that when I actually got my official stunt ticket, I almost immediately joined the James Bond team at Pinewood Studios, which is near where I lived. Which was a deliberate target move for me. There's a story behind that, which is not relevant to Mindo, but if you want it, I can tell it to you. It's up to you.
But, and I don't want
okay,
to miss out.
I'll be really quick. I lived near Ealing, and the Bond stunt coordinator I knew lived in Ealing. So I got my car, and my wife sat next to me, and we said, right, we'll go down a few blocks away, and we'll wait for him to go home. And I stood waiting for him to come. Knew he came out of the tube and walked up to his house. So I stood there and watched, ran back to my car, and then waited for him to start crossing the road, pulled out, and then drove at him and stopped. Went, oh, sorry, but didn't, you know, you walked out in front of me. Oh, are you Bob Simmons? And he went, yes, love, yes, love, yes, love. That's typical Bob. I went, oh, my goodness, I fancy seeing you here. And he went, I live here, I live here. And I went, oh, really? I said, I've just got on the stunt register. I didn't know you lived around here. I live around the corner. And he went, oh, do you, love? And you got a car? Well, okay. And I think that night he rang me saying, you couldn't give me a lift to Pinewood tonight, could you? So I literally targeted getting on that. And for a couple of years, I was known as Bob's driver because I literally stayed on his team. Two Bond films, Who Dares Wins, and various other things.
There's no need to cause unnecessary bad feeling with a client, Terry.
He ain't your client. Your friend in hospital is.
Ah, you know what I mean.
He was taking a...
No, he wasn't. You see, there you are. That's your inferiority complex again. He was simply asking you if you would like some nice Gordon Bleu food. That's what I mean about a chance to educate your mind.
Yeah, it ain't me mind I'm worried about. And I'll tell you one more time, if he makes any kind of move...
Don't start all that again. A nice cushy number. Don't nose it by needling the geezer. Give us your keys. Do you want anything in particular?
No, a couple of shirts, underwear, shaving gear, toothbrush, that sort of thing.
Right. Hey, what was all that about the bedroom?
Oh, it's super.
You are wrong about Alex.
Oh, yeah.
Moule Marinière. I do hope you like them.
Shells look like they'd be a bit hard.
Well, you must admit, it sounds a bit dodgy, Arthur.
Dodgy? You sound like Terry. Listen, if you knew this Alex, you wouldn't call him a woofter to his face, I can tell you that.
Yeah, how's Terry taken to having to stay with the other one?
Well, he loves it, don't he? Here, what's the time then?
Oh, it's nearly 6:30.
No, it's not. It's... Oh, mine seems to have stopped.
Fine.
Same again, please, Dave.
Righto.
You've done some incredible stuff. I mean, I couldn't... The list was that long that I had to sort of try and target things that I knew well, like... So I saw The Craze, Aliens, Superman 2, Hello, Hello, Sorry...
Listen, you've only got 20 minutes, but I did 10 years in radio. I knew everybody in music. I toured. I did 6 months at EMI Records for a while. So I toured with Bob Seger, toured with Mick DeVille, I toured with Dr. Hook as the promotions manager while I was between radio stations. So that was a mad 6 months with so much crushed into it. And I knew loads of people in the music industry. So when I became a stuntman, really weird, the beginning of the 80s saw the beginning of pop videos. So how I got to stunt coordinator so quick, and you may ask, because many other people take 10 years, is pop videos came out and they went catastrophic, huge. I've lost your picture, Paul. Videos went huge. And I got to do loads and loads of pop videos because I knew everybody from the pop industry. And it literally was a connection that was made in heaven. I mean, it was unbelievable. Now, The Craze was made by Fugitive Films, which was owned by Jim Beach, who was the manager of Queen, who set up a pop video company and a film company above Queen's playing area. So Queen's warehouse was down there with all their equipment, and they often used to come in and rehearse. We were just above in a mezzanine of old offices. And we put together loads and loads of pop videos. We did Elton John in the south of France. We did all kinds of stuff. And then we made The Craze, which was our first feature film. So I was actually a co-producer, which is why I've got that huge credit as a stunt coordinator at the front, because I was going, tell the world I am now a stunt coordinator.
Fabulous. The and you, I mean, in terms of, you mentioned Stay Lucky and Circle of Deceit, was that where you were doing the stunts for both of those? Well, there was a few programs of Circle of Deceit, I think, and then several episodes of Stay Lucky as well that you did.
Yeah. I basically was stunt coordinator and then would double Dennis when necessary. And there were some iconic episodes. I remember having to do a bungee jump in Italy for him. And we'd been out on a bender the night before and I was so ill. And I had to do an upside down bungee jump as Dennis, tied by the feet, jumping off a bridge. And how I didn't release everything that was in my body, I don't know. I was so ill. And he thought it was hilarious.
So yeah. Did you meet him just before that, or had you met him again in between? Because it was a good sort of 10 years, I think.
I think we'd met occasionally in between there when there was bits going on, or we'd pass each other on sets. But I think that I had a period of pop videos and films, which did not include Dennis. I'd gone on a tangent and then came back. Stay Lucky was the big one where he needed occasionally a stunt double. And it was often silly little things. So it was only, they weren't big. Very easy to become a stunt coordinator and stuff like that if you've done major films. And now, years on, I've retired, as it were. I don't do film sets anymore. The hours are too long.
You mentioned at the start that you're sort of athletically capable and trained and all these things. How do you transition, is that word again, from athletics and athletic build and capabilities to being able to do these things on camera that look realistic because you're doing it?
Yeah, I must admit, I knew nothing about stunts. I'd left school with one aim in mind, was to be a disc jockey and on radio. And my specific goal was to be the Radio 1 Breakfast Show DJ. I literally had just that one thing in mind. All I wanted to be was the Radio 1 Breakfast Show DJ. I managed to get on the BBC. And I managed to get the job as Tony Blackburn's assistant. Then I was Noel Evans' assistant when they switched over. But I realized then that they were employing stars. Even though it looked like I could work up through the ranks, they brought in Kid Jensen. They brought in Paul Burnett from Radio Luxembourg. And I knew I had to leave Radio 1 to come back. So that's when I did that 6 months at EMI. And I toured with Mink DeVille, Dr. Hook, Bob Seger, did all of that stuff. So I had a background of music. So when I started doing stunts, coincidentally, the pop video market went berserk with MTV and making pop videos. So all of the older stunt guys weren't interested. They were all movies, movies, movies. For me, it was a gift from heaven because all my old mates were making these videos. So I did things like Duran Duran's Wild Boys, a million-dollar budget pop video where you could go in and we'd come up with ideas. Right, let's fly this guy through the air. Yeah, crash him on the wall. Yeah, set him on fire. We just did all of these things. It was like a playground. So that pop video period was incredible. And I traveled all over the world. I went to the south of France with Elton John, all over the place. So I was very, very lucky. But this key connection is that I was making pop videos at Fugitive. And Fugitive was the company owned by Jim Beach. Jim Beach was the manager of Queen. And our office was with Queen's equipment. All of their touring equipment was kept in a warehouse just behind Capitol Radio. And we had the offices on the mezzanine floor, Ray Burdiss, Dominic Anciano, myself, and Steve Norrington, who went on to direct Blade. And there was a few others who were, managed to become or stay quite famous during that. And Steve Norrington became very famous for doing Blade and then a few other films. It was a playground of young creative guys. Say young, we were mid-20s, coming up to 30. So my going into stunts and making the craze and being able to produce it, so I said, right, put my name up at the front. Stuart St. Paul stunt coordinator in the biggest letters you can think of was me saying to the industry in this hit film, we hoped it would be a hit film, there's my name. the stunt industry went mad because how did you get your name at the front in big letters, single card? I asked for it. I didn't tell them I'd also produced the film, and they didn't make the connection. But that waltz of pop videos and all of those strange things I did, and Wild Boys was really one of them, led me to be picked up by other young creatives. So when James Cameron came over from the States, he'd seen my work in things like Wild Boys, and he called me in. And we went, he was trying to put together this monster, the Queen Alien. So we did the experiments for the Queen Alien. And I kind of could see what he was trying to do. He had a lot of problems in England working with the English crew, which is well documented. I'm not saying anything out of turn. Very well documented over all of the documentaries. And it was a very old-fashioned Masonic British Pinewood Studios. But the industry was changing very rapidly into this younger, hippie, creative, let's do this, let's do that. I know it's not on the list, but we can really do this and make this look good. And that's how James Cameron approached Aliens. And of course, I'd done that in pop videos. So we worked really well together. So he created the Queen Alien around my body and Malcolm Weaver's, strapped back to back. Took months. And then it took months to film it. But in the documentaries, you can see Malcolm and I being strapped together and Stan Winston coming up with molded, sculptured body parts. The funny part is, Steve Norrington was in the plaster shop of Aliens. So Steve was making the latex parts that went around my body when he and I were making Aliens, having both been at Fugitive and having both gone back to Fugitive afterwards, where he made his film Death Machine. I had my film Dream Hunter, which got signed to America, never got made. And because that collapsed, which was meant to be with James Caan and Jean-Marc Barr, I came back and can't remember who it was who offered it to me. Ziggy Kamasa, who went on to be the MD, CEO of Lionsgate Films. Ziggy said to me, you couldn't make this film The Scarlet Tunic for us, could you? If I gave you a script, could you bring it in for $100,000? And literally, he found more money in the end of Simon Callow. And I brought Jean-Marc Barr in. So that's how I moved into directing. And all through that, I kept doing the stunt coordinator. Now, you might ask why, but the simple answer is the stunt guys are the highest paid people on a film set. On a TV set, a stunt guy is paid for a day, almost what the director gets for a whole week. So when after Scarlet Tunic, ICM called me and they said, we could shop you as a director. I said, well, what in? And they said, well, television, you can go and direct TV. And I went, no, I'm already doing TV. I've already got an A-list career in TV doing stunts. And I'm getting paid for a day. What you're suggesting I go and do for a week. And that doesn't make sense to an East End lad who used to work on a fruit and vegetable. The money doesn't add up. So I stayed doing stunts. Now, that may have been wrong because David Yates, who was my contemporary at the time as a director, working in the same thing, went on to direct Harry Potter and became, through the long route of TV directing, multimillionaire and being given scripts to read. You know, I'm paid $25,000 to read a script. So I kind of didn't get to that jump level. But I had a wonderful career in the way I could actually buzz around and earn a considerable sum of money and choose what I did direct. So the films that I did direct were sometimes very dark pieces, but it's because I could choose to do something I wanted to do. I didn't have to do it for a living. I was doing stunts for a living. That's paid the mortgage.
Look, I'm not exactly crazy about staying here either.
I do think the least Alex could have done was to forewarn me.
It was sprung on me a bit and all. Still, won't be in hospital long, will he?
At least 10 weeks, I should think.
10 weeks? For abrasions?
I'd hardly call having practically every bone in your body broken abrasions.
You were joking.
I don't joke.
Bloody Arthur. But listen, these two merchants who came in the shop and put the frighteners on, now, what they look like?
Hard to say. All those butch macho types look much the same to me.
Yeah, well, did either of them mention each other's name?
No.
And they didn't say when they'd be back?
No.
It's funny, they usually do.
I wouldn't know.
10 bleeding weeks.
I don't know what to say. I mean, I can hardly believe it.
Well, it's true. He finally came out of the closet. I'd suspected for some time, of course, but could never really prove it.
But, I mean, Alex, he was always so... Well, you know.
To the outside world? Yes. Bastard. I hope he catches something.
Catches something? Oh, Gloria, you can't really mean that.
Oh, yes, I bloody do. Help yourself.
Oh, ta. I mean, I can see, you know. I mean, I can see it upset you a bit.
A bit?
Well, a man is in hospital with a badly broken body.
No more than he deserves.
Well, he still looks after you, though, doesn't he?
He pays the bills. Just. When he was still living with me, he was quite generous. I suppose that was the guilt. Now he no longer has anything to hide. He's turned into Mr. Tightwad.
Do the kids know?
That he's mean?
No. That he's, you know...
That their father is a queen? Nah, of course not.
Queen Gloria.
Is the do you just do the action, as in whatever action's needed, you just do it? Is it the director's responsibility or editor's to make it look like the person you're supposed to be? Or do you have to sort of do certain things?
Well, in the old days, I know people go, oh, it would be so nice to shoot on film. But if you look at film and you look at the old TV, it's not that clear. And as soon as you go to a wide shot, you can't always see in great detail who it is. Mm-hmm. So there was a saying within the stunt industry, it could be a blind man, it could be a monkey up a tree smoking a pipe and a blind man would never see it. So when a producer would go, but you look nothing like Dennis, the old guy would go, yeah, well, it could be a monkey up a tree smoking a pipe and a blind man would never see it. That was their answer. And you've got all the wrong people doubling actors.
Yeah.
But as television improved, and certainly when it went digital, we have these wonderful cameras in there. The sets had to be improved. The doubles have to be accurate. Everybody has to look the same. So now the casting process does go, can we get somebody the right size? And most people... So I doubled face in the 18, but yeah. He hated me double because I'm about 6 inches shorter. And he hated the fact that there was somebody smaller in stature than him when he wanted somebody bigger. You know, he wants to be made muscly.
Yeah.
But face-wise, I could pass as Dirk Benedict.
Yeah.
You know, we were good, you know, that's that Dennis Waterman type, you know, the Carl Howman-shaped face that so many people had. Doubled Carl, doubled so many people. And you try and cast the right person. So responsibility wise, as the stunt coordinator, you offer up the people that you deem to be correct to do the job. So if I'm doing an aerial stunt and I might need somebody falling down a sheet and unwrapping themselves, I will find somebody with that talent. If I need somebody to ride a motorbike, it'll be a different person. In the old days, they'd get one guy and just bodge trying to do everything. You can't do that. The responsibility in health and safety is you find the right person for the right job. I present them to production. Then production take my paperwork, which says this is the risk. The person's driving a car into a tree at 40 miles an hour. The car's been prepped. In doing so, we've altered the design and possibly the safety. But we are certain that the car supplier, I would say, because you have to word this so right. It's going to be in court one day. The car supplier has altered it it's been saved. The petrol has been removed, all of that stuff. And the driver is aware that he's driving a car into a tree. And he is aware he could be damaged. And we are all aware that in extreme, somebody could die from this. Now, you have to produce this what if and percentage thought. You know, the chances of him dying, less than 10%. Chances of him being injured, less than 30%. Does he know what he's doing? Yes, 100%. Do you want to take the risk, Mr. Producer? if you need that stunt, the answer is yes, I am going to take that risk. But I have produced a list like that in the past on some stunts, in television in particular, where TV producers are not prepared to take that risk and the stunt will get cancelled, or you will do something more simple. So the risk is, I am an employee of the company, and effectively the producers and the director, the executive producers, all take responsibility, which you might argue, if you're in America and you happen to have a gun and it's not supposed to be loaded and you aim it and have to shoot somebody and they happen to die, and you've also taken the role as being the executive producer as well as the actor, you cannot escape the responsibility, because you as the actor did it, but you as the executive producer oversaw the person you allowed to do it. Mm. So it's a complicated court case. I'm not suggesting anything like that might happen, but if it did, it would be in court and there would be serious lawyers backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
And lawyers only work if there's money to be earned. So if you've got lots of money, they'll sue you. You've got nothing.
Yeah. Which is fascinating.
I was involved in something 10 years ago and got injured. It wasn't even a stunt. I just happened to be on set. And I haven't worked on set since then, but decided to stay in touch with the industry by writing, which is what I do now. And I go on cruise ships and I talk about my time working with Dennis, working on this, working on as Queen Alien. My next ship's an American ship. So obviously I won't talk about Dennis Waterman. They won't be so familiar. But the British ships know Dennis, so I will talk from on a P&O ship or Cunard ship. I might talk about Minder. I might talk about all of the British shows I did. But if I'm on an American ship, I'll talk about Seed of Chucky. I'll talk about Aliens. I'll talk about the Bond films, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Batman, and those films.
What's your kind of go-to Dennis story that you always tell that we may not have heard?
I normally mention the, you know, sometimes having too much fun one evening and turning up on the set feeling worse for wear and having to do that bungee jump. because I do actually have a picture of me dressed to do that. So I come somewhere and I've got a few, but I don't. The big problem is, you know, in the early 80s, we didn't have camera phones. So I don't have pictures of me and Dennis on set, us, you know. Plus, because you were just at work and they were your colleagues or friends, you didn't go, "Oh, give us a selfie." Why would you? It just doesn't seem right. But nowadays, if you're smart, and everybody's smart, and everybody's on social media, and everybody knows they need numbers, everybody's taking pictures of them with whoever they're working with. Whole different ballgame. When I got injured on a film set, which was 10 years ago, I wasn't well. I ended up having to have brain surgery because I was set on fire in an explosion. Wasn't doing stunts. I wasn't even there on the set, but something went wrong away from the set. And nothing to do with stunts. It was a special effect thing. Anyway, I was suffering. And the therapist at the time who was working with me prior to the brain surgery said, "Look, our big goal is to do two things. One, to make sure you end your career or to continue your career. We'd love to get you back to work, but as that's not going to happen, two things. You need to look at your career in a good light. So you need to pick up all of these things you did, all of these millions of shows you've done, and we need to get you. So take these cruise ships offers and go and talk about your career because people will want to listen." He wanted me to write a biography. I said, "I can't do that because it won't sell. I don't know, maybe one day I will do that." But while I was on the cruise ships talking about my career, which was part of my therapy, and you have to write as part of therapy, if you've been through it, you know, Cruise Ship Heist was the first book. And after I had the brain surgery, I went back and then re-looked at Cruise Ship Heist and edited it down because I was in a much better place. So it's now out as a second version, and it's the first book in the series. And there are 7 cruise crime thrillers. Which are real page turners. They're real sort of Tom Hanks. I'd love Ron Howard to pick him up and make the 7 films. But, you know, fingers crossed.
How do you want people to be able to buy those? Is the link, do you have a special link or is it just
Amazon? You can just search them on Amazon, Cruise Ship Heist. is on Amazon. You can just pick it up as me reading it as an audio book or as a Kindle. You can get a paperback as well, but paperbacks are very expensive nowadays unless they're a bestseller and they can be discounted. Publishers send them off as a loss leader because the money is in selling the for anybody, publishers or writers. As you know, you're an author. A Kindle is going to make you more money than trying to get a paper book out to somebody, which is so costly to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd love them to go on Amazon and find Cruise Ship Heist. That would be great. It will be on Apple Books and Google Books soon because they are now beginning to compete with Amazon's Kindle. But who knows what the future is? Entertainment changes so fast. But Cruise Ship Heist is out there. You can find it.
I will include the link in our episode on the website. No worries. Thank you so much for your time, Stuart. It's been brilliant.
Oh, you don't know what that. This has been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Just remember. Thank you.
Awesome. All right. Thanks a lot. Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. My immense thanks to Stuart for taking the time to speak with me. We could have gone on for hours, and there is obviously a lot more from his career that we could have covered. But being a good pro, Stuart kept it relevant to this show as much as possible. Hope you enjoyed it too. Stuart is a regular after-dinner speaker on land and around the world on cruise ships. Now he has a cruise crime book series, CSCI. The best way to purchase the series is in the first box set of 6 novels. Please see the link on the page for this show. Thanks to all of those of you who've written in about the Nick Pearson interview. I've had a lot of positive comments. Thanks to all of you who've written in and are recommending the podcast too. Apparently there are a huge amount of Minder fans who still don't know about this show, and I appreciate you mentioning the show to anyone who you think might enjoy it. Feel free to rate the show on IMDb and Spotify also. I've noticed a lot of new listeners recently, and apparently we've gone from around 3% female listeners to 11%. Not sure why this is, but it's an interesting statistic, as is the number of younger listeners coming in and just discovering the show. I don't even mean my show, but actually Minder. I didn't think of people listening to the show who were new to Minder itself, but I suppose it is inevitable, with the show still being shown on TV quite regularly. Not everyone under the age of 40 is woke and politically correct 24/7. One new listener, Adam Hawkins, wrote to me saying, "Dear Paul, as only a recent addition to the Minder podcast community, I would like to thank you for bringing us so many fascinating insights and little known or long forgotten facts about the people involved in bringing us this much missed series. I was on a business trip to South America last year, and with a few days off, flew down to Ushuaia in the far reaches of Patagonia, having then been holed up in my small hotel by severe weather and suffering from a bout of homesickness. I decided to download and watch some homegrown and old school quality TV. And so it was that I was watching Gunfight at the OK Laundrette in what must be the most southerly location on the planet, unless the Antarctica expedition are keen fans. Keep up the good work, it is much appreciated. Kind regards." Well, thanks very much, Adam, for writing, and you make a good point. I recall after the first few years of living abroad, I really started to crave British television. It's not just Minder, of course, but it should be anyone's first go-to British programme. Like Adam says, homegrown and old-school quality TV. That's what it's all about. You may notice that I've been a little bit longer than usual in following up with this show. That's because of various other commitments. But rest assured, I've also been working behind the scenes on a few things for this show. So next time I might follow up with an episode I've been working on for a while, if I can finish it. Otherwise, there are a couple of other interviews already completed, so look out for those soon. Thanks for listening.